السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Good evening, Khuyanand Mulweni, and a hearty welcome to the Shahida Kali Show. I'm very excited because tonight I speak with a very special guest, and we're having a telephonic link up with Professor Christine Lochner, who is the co-director of MRC's Unit on Anxiety and Stress Disorders, Department of Psychiatry at the University of Stellenbosch, and some very exciting things that are happening in this unit, that of which Professor will be telling us about it. So let me greet Professor and welcome her to the program. Good evening, Professor Christine Lochner, and welcome to the program.
Thank you, Samira. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, I'm actually very, very excited to speak with you. And I'm, you know, just to tell our listeners that we will, for example, in more detail be speaking about obsessive compulsive disorder in this week. And then next week we're hoping to focus on social anxiety disorders and social phobia. So, you know, just so that they have a sense of what we will be talking about additionally to what is happening that is exciting in your unit. So perhaps to first start off by telling us what's happening in the unit and the types of research that's happening there, please.
Well, Shahida, there's a whole lot of things going on, and our focus, we've got different research projects, obviously.
Yes.
Before I go on, let me just apologize. My voice sounds terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I actually caught flu last week. So please excuse.
Shame. Well, I hope it's not going to be difficult for you and perhaps strain your voice. What does it sound like?
No worries.
It will be okay?
It's fine, Shahida. I would like to request that we actually speak about our social anxiety work that we're doing tonight. And
that's absolutely fine.
Skip to the OCD work next weekend.
That's absolutely fine. What I would like is, especially with your voice, you know, being in the condition that it is,
yes,
if you can speak as close to the microphone and into the phone as possible,
yes,
it will mean that the quality of your voice will come through a lot clearer.
Okay.
Right? I mean, I can hear that you're speaking closer to the phone and the mouthpiece
is
of the phone now.
Is that better?
That's absolutely better. We can hear you clearly. I thought when you answered, I thought, wow, what a husky voice.
Oh, my word. Normally it's much higher and sweeter.
I'm sure it's going to be absolutely fine. If you will then tell us a little bit of, you know, the projects that are happening and the research that's happening in the unit that is particularly pertaining to the program in which we wanting to reach out to possible participants.
Yes. So we've got a whole lot of different projects with different foci.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, originally the unit centered around, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder,
yes,
social anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
But in recent years, we had to expand, so we now include interesting things like HIV,
mm-hmm,
research on hair pulling disorder, gambling disorder,
mm-hmm,
even tick, you know, and all of these projects include fascinating aspects, you know, the clinical aspects that we look at,
yeah,
the genetic underpinnings,
mm-hmm,
we do neuroimaging,
yeah,
so it's and even some studies we do treatment. So today this evening I will mention the work that we currently do on social anxiety disorder.
Okay.
Which I find fascinating.
All right. I'm sure. And so you're doing getting to understand more about social anxiety disorder and then also how that would inform your treatment. Is that what
absolutely
the research is
absolutely
about? Great, no, absolutely great.
I think with most of these research projects, you know, the
yes
aim is obviously to gain as much information,
yeah,
and insight as possible, but also, you know, not only to benefit the participants, but also in future, have our findings translate into better treatment.
Right.
You know, for everyone.
Right. That's absolutely great. I just want to speak a little bit about, you know, the research before we get into social anxiety disorder and social phobia as the disorders per se. Mm-hmm. Perhaps just to speak a little bit about what are you wanting to achieve from this program in terms of, you know, participants and explaining to them what is happening and how they can actually be a part of the program.
Okay, I think that's a wonderful place to start. You know, this particular project, it started in January already,
mm-hmm.
and we are looking for 15 participants with social anxiety disorder,
yeah.
Also known as social phobia,
yeah.
and then 15 healthy controls, you know, people without social anxiety.
Yeah.
And they should be 18 years or older,
mm-hmm.
but younger than 55.
Okay.
And they should be right-handed.
Yeah.
Huh. And they shouldn't have a history of, you know, a brain injury or current medical conditions such as diabetes, you know, things that could affect the brain scans.
Mm-hmm.
Because it entails, this project actually entails quite a number of different facets.
Okay.
So we would want participants to be as homogeneous as possible. That's why we include only right-handed participants, you know,
okay.
for instance.
Okay. So when you say homogeneous, I haven't used that word in a long time. I would like for you to just explain to our listeners what you would mean in relation to the fact that you have specified certain things that you would not want present or want present.
Yeah.
Please.
So obviously we would like the 15 patients with social anxiety to be as similar as possible in terms of their current status, you know, say their handedness or education level, that kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
so that if there are differences between the control group and the social anxiety disorder group, that we can ascribe it to social anxiety and not to anything else.
Right.
So that's why we would want people to be as similar as possible in their respective groups.
And gender?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't
We've got
matter.
A whole lot of female participants thus far. I think females are much more keen on I don't know, participation, or they may have more time. I don't know. Maybe the males are too shy to call. I don't know.
Yeah.
But we've had much more response from ladies than from men.
Okay. I'm going to ask you, because we need to take commercial news, but, you know, to hold the answer, I'd like to ask the question of when people phone contact you, do you perhaps have a form that they have to complete in which you can have them tick off, no, I don't have diabetes, I don't have this, I haven't had a brain injury, etc. And please hold the answer while we take commercial news. Stay with us.
Live from Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape.
Shahida Kali, and I'm speaking with the co-director of the MRC Unit on Anxiety and Stress Disorders, Department of Psychiatry at the University of Stellenbosch, Professor Christine Lochner, and we're focusing on the research that's happening in this unit, as well as touching on social anxiety disorder and social phobia, which is the focus of the research of which you can actually be a part of. So let's just ask the question, Professor, when someone contacts you, will there be a questionnaire or a process through which they will be asked certain questions in order to establish the similarity of your participants?
Yes, indeed, Shaira. I think that is probably the most important part before you participate or mm-hmm. before you can be included.
Yeah.
So there will be a questionnaire either administered by me personally or by my assistant, mm-hmm. who is Leon Talyard.
Mm-hmm.
And so we will ask this person whether they think they've got social anxiety disorder or whether they've been diagnosed with it before. It doesn't matter if they haven't been diagnosed. You know, we are fully capable of doing that. But if they think, you know, if they think they have a problem with social interaction or performance situations, then they're welcome to call in. So we'll ask all sorts of questions, you know, the age, whether they have any major health problems such as diabetes or a serious medical illness or a previous brain injury. They can't participate if they have metal implants such as pacemakers because it affects the MRI scan.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll ask whether they are claustrophobic, obviously, because it includes a brain imaging component.
Yes.
You know, we cannot include people who get anxious in small spaces.
Right.
They should be right-handed. And obviously, we ask how much caffeine do they use.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, too much also affects the brain scans.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we would like to not include people with comorbid conditions, which means anything in addition to social anxiety.
Okay,
also confuse the data.
Right. I was actually going to ask that question. If someone has a dual diagnosis, perhaps depression, you know, and even PTSD for that matter, you know, and that perhaps resulted in social anxiety disorder.
Yes.
But what I wanted to ask is, what about co-diagnosis that has a physiological basis? You've mentioned diabetes, so there will be certain certain conditions that will exclude the person from the process?
Yes, indeed. We've had, for instance, one participant already
mm-hmm.
who were excluded because of some kidney disease,
mm-hmm.
who excluded him from participation.
Okay.
So there are certain medical conditions
yes.
which would definitely interfere with the neuroimaging, and that we don't want. Obviously, that would confuse the findings.
Okay. Just another question on that, because I think I'm asking these technical questions because mm-hmm. of listeners being able to identify, okay, I fit, and therefore I can phone, you know, and hence my, you know, further questioning. Would the acuteness or severity of the diagnosis of social phobia or social anxiety disorder, will that play a role?
Actually, you know, if you have, if the person has social anxiety disorder, it mm-hmm. doesn't matter the severity.
Okay.
You know, as long as they've got a primary condition or a one and only condition of social anxiety disorder, which interferes with their functioning, they are included.
Right. I would imagine it isn't a very easy task to find these participants if you think that social phobia very, very often has a dual diagnosis with depression.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it, hey?
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
We're in May already, and people will think, okay, well, 15 in each group, it sounds very easy, you know?
Yeah.
You should have had that by Feb.
Right.
But it's not that easy. You know, we're in May now, and we've had 9 people with social anxiety who qualified for inclusion.
Mm-hmm.
And of those 9, 2 already just decided to stop.
Okay.
The one just got cold feet, and the other one started with some other medication, and she thought, okay, she's going to stop the study medication.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's difficult. It's actually quite difficult to get social phobia in isolation without substances or without depression within the 18 to 55 window.
Right.
Yeah.
I would also want to ask, because the person will have a diagnosis of social anxiety disorder, in itself, it would mean that they will be wary of interacting with the research person who is conducting the research because of the nature of their diagnosis. But what I also want to ask is, would there be the fear that they will be in contact and kind of exposed to other or other participants, and the difficulty because of their diagnosis? Have you encountered that?
Oh, absolutely.
It's not easy, is it?
Very often from the participants they couldn't pick up the phone, and that they've seen advertisements before, they just cannot pick up the phone to phone.
Right.
You know, and once they're there, I saw a patient this week.
Yes.
She doesn't come out of the house without taking a calming medication, a tranquilizer.
Yeah.
And
shame.
So I hooked her. She must come this week for all of her sessions because I'm worried that she might get cold feet.
Yes.
It's so disabling. You know, I see it. I saw someone yesterday on Saturday morning.
Yeah.
She came in and she was shaking.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Sweating profusely and blushing. Yeah. And, you know, the rest.
Yeah.
And
may I ask, because I think when you do this type of research, you probably have to have the psychologist who does the therapy. If the person really has a very bad attack of anxiety, that there has to be someone who holds the heart of the person and takes them through that process.
Oh yeah, mm-hmm. I'm a clinical psychologist myself, so
yes.
I actually have a lot of empathy with anxiety.
All right.
And because I see this kind of participant so very often, I actually know what to expect.
Yeah.
So you comfort them from the beginning, you get them tea, you make them sit down and, you know, take their time, you explain everything. And because it's a long session, you know, the first one with me, once they survive the screening and they come and see me, it's a session of about 2 to 3 hours. So, you know, by the end of it, they're sort of much more calm and open to the process and positive to continue that kind of thing.
I'm sure. And just a question. So people must understand then that this whole process, the entire period of process, will be voluntary on their behalf.
Absolutely. It's voluntary. They can chicken out at any stage.
Okay.
It is confidential, obviously, so I won't call your boss and tell that you're participating or whoever. It remains confidential. It's your choice.
Okay. And is there, if people were to ask, are there any benefits from being a part of the program? And oh my goodness, we've got to take commercial news. Please hold the thought. You know, we will get back to you after the commercial news.
From Cape Town, this is the Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape. The Voice of the Cape.
Shahida Kali, and I'm speaking with Professor Christine Lochner. We're talking about research that's being done in her unit at the University of Stellenbosch. So, Professor, if anyone is interested in being a part of the research, are there benefits? And if so, what would those benefits be, please?
Well, from my side, there are many benefits, but from the participant's point of view, because the study includes a treatment, intervention component, which entails a medication which is already on the market for social anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not testing a medication. Very importantly, we're not testing it, but we do use a medication called meclobamide, which is the active ingredient, and we use it for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
So the participant, the social phobic participant can expect to have a reduction in their social anxiety. You know, it's on the market for this condition, so it has been proven by randomized controlled trials that it does work for social phobia. So, in theory, the participant can expect to do better.
All right. And may I ask, the intervention that is being given to the participant, besides medication, will they also have psychotherapy at the time when they are a part of the process?
No, not at all. So it's
only the medication?
And it's a lengthy pre-testing intervention, post-testing type of process.
Okay. So the period in which the participant will be involved in the research would be roughly how long?
It would be roughly about 9 weeks.
Okay.
So it's about two months and a bit.
Okay. All right. Where would this take place? You did say that they have to come for brain imaging, etc.
Yeah.
So would it all be happening at the university?
It will take place at Tygerberg Hospital, mm-hmm. and the medical campus at Tygerberg.
Okay, all right. And so who does one phone or contact if one was interested to be a participant?
Sherry, you know, I think what would be best is if they email me, if
yes.
they've got email. It's cl2@sun.ac.za.
Mm-hmm.
Or they can give me a call on 021-938-9179.
Yes.
Or they can contact the Mental Health Information Center
mm-hmm.
on 021-938-9229.
Okay, I'm going to reiterate these numbers at a later stage, but for now, you know, if people will probably be grabbing their pens and papers so that they mm-hmm. can write down the information. Let's talk about social anxiety disorder and social phobia mm-hmm. so that we can, you know, alert our listeners in terms of identifying themselves as a possible participant
really?
For this research. So perhaps, you know, I'm going to go by the questions that you've actually sent to me. For me, the first question that you had said we'll speak about would be, what is social anxiety disorder according to psychiatric guidelines?
Yeah, so social anxiety disorder is the latest nomenclature in DSM-5, which is our diagnostic manual. It was previously used, known as a social phobia. So in short, people with social anxiety disorder get extremely anxious around others in everyday social situations. They get really, really anxious beforehand even. And they basically fear that they will act in a way or show anxiety symptoms that will be embarrassing or humiliating.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for instance, this girl that I saw yesterday, she was absolutely so conscious of her blushing, you know, and she
mm-hmm.
knew she was shaking. You know, afterwards she told me there's no way that she could have asked for a glass of water or coffee because her hands were shaking so much.
Yes.
You know, so, and secondly, people with social anxiety disorder, once they are exposed to these kinds of social situations, you know, it sort of elicits incredible anxiety, and they might even have a panic attack in
yes.
those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And usually what they do is avoid, you know, so they don't
yeah.
go out, they don't
yeah.
go to parties, they, you know, they never do an oral in class.
Yeah.
They take a course at varsity where they don't have to do an oral examination.
Yes.
You know, that kind of extreme avoidance.
Yeah.
And it's sort of it's a chronic condition. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's not only in certain circumstances. It's usually chronic where you see this as a child, they're quite shy, and then later on they, you know, mm-hmm. they avoid dating or they find it extremely stressful, that kind of thing. And, you know, usually I see people when they struggle in the workplace, when they see that people get promoted above them and they do have more potential than their colleagues, you know,
mm-hmm.
or they believe they have more potential, but they can't sort of manifest it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you will only diagnose social anxiety disorder when there is a sort of impairment, you know, or dysfunction
mm-hmm.
in everyday situations.
Okay, so it becomes very difficult for them to live a normal life. That's what you're saying, because I think you refer to a lady who wouldn't even leave her house.
Yes,
Okay. I just, you know, as you were describing this, and I haven't really listened to the description the way it was just explained to me in this way, I was just thinking how difficult it must be to have a participant who doesn't have panic disorder as a dual diagnosis, you know, really preempting, I'm going to have a panic attack, I'm going to have anxiety, and which will then, develop into panic disorder. Must be a biggie.
It's often difficult to decide, you know, is this really panic disorder or is this social anxiety?
But
you would only diagnose social anxiety if the person has panic attacks in social situations. And not other situations as well.
I, you know, was listening to you describing the blushing and the shaking and so on. And perhaps, you know, to describe a little bit more of the symptoms so that people can identify more. I think you very often see the blushing, particularly in fair-skinned people. You know, that it is shame and the heat, the warmth that they feel that floods their head. Oh, my word, is so uncomfortable. But perhaps to speak about other symptoms as well?
Well, I think those are sort of the main things that you would notice. You know, you won't notice the sweaty palms.
Yeah.
Or you might, even if you know, sometimes when I shake hands with participants, you know, I mean, you can feel the sweaty palms.
But I'd like for you to describe it, because I think many people might need for you to describe some of the, you know, that which are kind of the covert symptoms of social phobia. You know, that would include, for example, you know, heart palpitations and so on. But if you would, I really would appreciate that.
Shaira, So on the surface, you would notice the blushing, even the sweating.
Yeah.
You know, some people sweat profusely when they get anxious.
Yeah.
Even you would also notice, you know, jumping legs, you know, that kind of, those people who don't sit still ever, they fidget. Just all the time, but then some people also present with palpitations.
Yeah.
You know, they feel like their heart is jumping through their throat. Their tummies turn around. They feel nauseous, even stomach aches. You know, for instance, there's a type of social anxiety disorder or a subtype that you would only have in performance situations.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would be fine or relatively fine with friends or meeting strangers, but once they have to do an oral presentation or do a talk in front of a class or do a radio talk, you know, that would make them their hearts palpitate, sweat profusely, that kind of thing. So you must understand that social anxiety disorder can often only present in certain circumstances like that.
Yes.
And then they would have these typical symptoms of blushing, sweating, avoidance, that kind of thing.
Okay. And when you say avoidance, of course, you know, referring to avoidance of circumstances that will that will bring forth the anxiety. But do you also will find self-isolation?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, people with social anxiety disorder are usually lonely. They want to be with people.
Yes.
So if you're someone who enjoys your own company and you're on your own mostly, you know, it doesn't mean you've got social anxiety disorder.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, but if you're at home and you are desperately wanting to be part of a group, or you want to join a group, or you want to date, or but you cannot.
Yeah.
Then you've got social anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I often also see how people struggle with initiating a conversation.
Oh, absolutely.
They will desperately want to say something or converse with someone, but they just cannot initiate it. They can be a part of it once someone else speaks with them, but it's very difficult to start a conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, in general, I think it is hard for most people, you know.
Yeah.
And this is, I think, a classic of people with social anxiety disorder. They think that other people do this easily.
Yes.
You know, they think that everyone else is socially fine and socially okay and confident and so on. So they believe everyone is doing this with the greatest of ease, which is total nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, most of us, it takes a bit of effort to you know, come out of our shell or to introduce yourself to other people or to make do a presentation.
Yeah.
I think most of us are slightly anxious in those circumstances, likely to more. But people with social anxiety disorder would think they are the only people who struggle with this.
Yes.
And everyone else is fine.
Yes, and I suppose there's a lot of self-judgment or the fear of others judging them, isn't it? Oh, if I'm going to open my mouth, they're going to think I'm stupid.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And when they say something, you know, that one sentence or that one word will be evaluated and ruminated and evaluated afterwards. And mostly they will end up feeling terrible or, you know, thinking that they're never going to open their mouths again.
Yes. Yes, how debilitating. I think I often, you know, when I interact with people with social phobia, it really, it just elicits such sadness in a person to think that, you know, the person struggles so, so much. And it's quite sore. It is really sore for them.
Absolutely. Mm. You know, and once you get to the age of 50.
Yeah.
It's very hard, you know, it's really hard. Then, you know, one of our participants said, and I found it very sad, he said he has missed the boat, you know.
Shame.
He has missed the boat. He hasn't dated. He hasn't done the, you know, the marriage, the kids, that kind of thing, has missed the boat. And, you know, and that sort of, that sums it up for me, how much these people can miss out,
of course.
You know, the things that folk without social anxiety disorder take for granted.
Yes. I also think just the longing that they have in their heart for it to be different, to feel different.
Yes.
Is also very, very heart sore.
Absolutely.
You know, so having described it, and I'm hoping that, you know, people will get a sense or kind of place them, you know, in the description that you've just described. I now want to also speak about your healthy participants.
Yes.
Who would they be?
Well, healthy is always a relative term, right?
Yeah, and this is why I thought it would be so critical to ask this question.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, we are looking for people to compare our social anxiety disorder patients with. So if we have a 30-year-old female Caucasian lady, with social anxiety disorder, we would obviously like to include someone similar, you know, more or less that age group, population group, but without social anxiety disorder, and they should be without any psychiatric condition.
Okay, and so perhaps just a question, if you are saying Caucasian, if you can please explain in normal English terms for our listeners. They might not understand.
Well, it's we see people of any race, any color, any language.
Yes.
But obviously we focus on Afrikaans, English, and we've got Xhosa consent forms.
Yes.
So, and we will have a translator if need be.
Okay.
And we would like our controls to be comparable to our patients in terms of sex or age or population group.
Yes.
So at this stage, you know, beggars can't be choosers, so we screen everyone that call in.
Yes.
And based on that screening, we invite them to come along.
Yeah.
And then we do a similar, you know, the same assessment that we do with patients, we do with our healthy controls, just to make sure that they don't have a current, they can have, you know, stuff in the past. They can, you know, they could have had depression or any psychiatric disorder in the past, except schizophrenia, which is just sort of a psychotic illness, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They should not be on medication, obviously, on psychiatric medication.
Okay. I hope that this discussion will educate listeners as well to understand how research isn't just easy. I mean, the first stage of just getting your participants, how difficult it is. Oh. It's quite a challenge.
It is very challenging. But that, that keeps it interesting.
It's part of the process, isn't it? And then, of course, there's the constant concern of, oh, no one must just drop out, stay.
Oh, my word. Yes, absolutely.
So I really think, when we're speaking with our listeners, we would want to say to them, when you do start the process, and you become a participant, don't drop out. It's stunning that you can be a part of knowledge formation.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are part of creating knowledge and more understanding, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we have to take commercial news. I'd want to for you to speak about the benefits, of the research to the psychiatric community before we say to the, because we've discussed a little bit the benefits to the participants. I'd like for you just to speak about the benefits to the psychiatric and psychological community so that they can see how they're actually a part of a great body of knowledge. But stay with us, don't go away. Welcome back. I'm Shahida Kali, and I'm speaking with Professor Christine Lochner, who is the co-director at the MRC Unit on Anxiety and Stress Disorders, Department of Psychiatry at the University of Stellenbosch. We're discussing a research project, and it is particularly focusing, this research project is focusing on social anxiety disorder. I think in the past, mostly, we would have referred to it as social phobia, the extreme anxiety when you know that you have to interact socially. And like Christine, Professor, had mentioned, sometimes you see this coming afore when people have to present something or stand up in front of people and talk or deliver an oral. To encourage our listeners who are matched for this research project, I asked the question of what is the benefit to the psychiatric community, but actually the health professional community. Please, if you would, Professor.
Well, Shahida, as I've said earlier, it would be of benefit to the patients themselves because they can expect to get better.
Yes.
They have a reduction in their social anxiety. Mm-hmm. But to us, obviously the aim, any research project, the aim would be to increase knowledge or increase our insights into how conditions work.
Yes.
And for instance, with social anxiety disorder, we know that the thinking patterns of people with social anxiety disorder, it differs from people without,
Yes.
So you and I would interpret something totally different to how someone with social anxiety would.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, I would see someone frown, and I would just think, okay, they are concentrating. Whereas someone with social anxiety would think, oh my word, I've offended them, or, they have a problem with me, or they don't like me, that kind of thing. So we know that their thinking patterns differ.
Yes.
And this study is sort of focused on those neural networks, the brain networks.
Yeah.
And these networks, it actually refer to how parts of the brain communicate with each other, and we think that these networks are different in people with social anxiety disorder compared to healthy controls.
Mm-hmm.
And we think that if people with social anxiety disorder are given a sort of a proven treatment for the condition, which is the moclobemide,
mm-hmm.
these networks might change. But we want to actually investigate this. It hasn't been shown before. So we actually investigate these possible changes by doing a bunch of tests beforehand, computer-based tests.
Yes.
And we do brain scans before and after the treatment.
Okay.
So with that knowledge, hopefully we'd be able to say how moclobemide works or how treatment in social anxiety works, how it affects these brain networks.
Yes.
so that obviously we can choose the best treatments in future for people with this condition.
Okay.
You know, if we, the more we increase that specific knowledge, the more we are able to develop the new treatments even.
Right. I just want to ask, and again, as you know, you are chatting with me, these thoughts come afore. You do the brain imaging, then there will be the period with medication use, and then there will be the brain imaging afterwards. I'm just thinking how stunning it would be to do brain imaging whilst social interaction is taking place.
Absolutely.
You know, and is that a part of the research, or is that not possible at this stage?
Well, what we do during, you know, before and after is what we call a MRI scan,
yes.
And part of it is an fMRI, which is we look at certain functions of the brain,
yes.
Specifically how it works,
yeah.
And we do certain tasks while the person is lying in the scanner.
Right.
And some of it contains aspects of social, you know, emotional recognition, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So certain brain areas might be more activated or underactivated,
yeah.
In people with social anxiety disorder. So we test that, but we don't in vivo, you know, go out and look at their interaction.
Right.
Unfortunately, we're not able to do that, but
yeah.
We definitely do an fMRI.
What a pity, isn't it? But although I would say, I mean, we understand that when you have social phobia, just the thought of interacting socially can actually bring about all those symptoms.
Absolutely. All those areas are activated,
yeah.
Most definitely.
Right. So, it would be so, so interesting. I must tell you that I've been, you know, present where we looked at dreams and how the brain changes at different times with, you know, within sleep and when the person is having a dream and so on. It is absolutely fascinating. It is so, it's almost beautiful, mm-hmm. if one has to put it that way. I think, you know, neuropsych and neuropsychiatry and psychology is very, very interesting.
Definitely.
For now, I think a question that I didn't ask, that I almost feel bad to ask, but I do have to ask, is whether participants will be paid.
Well, you have to ask that question because I think a lot of people are struggling,
yes.
You know. So in terms of payments, obviously we can't pay participants.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know a lot of people are very needy out there, so
yes.
Offering them payment would sort of not be ethically correct. However,
mm-hmm.
Transport will be covered,
yes.
As far as possible.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because we keep them there for a long time, you know, so 3 hours at a time, it can be quite lengthy. You know,
yes.
we keep them alive with coffee and tea and snacks, if requested.
Right. Okay, fine. But I suppose one has to, like you've just explained, when you are doing research, then from an ethical perspective, one cannot have payment because it might influence people to,
yes.
give you answers,
yes.
That's not entirely true.
Absolutely.
So if our listeners can understand that it's actually from that point of view that payment would then be unethical, you know, that they can, that they need to understand that. I think it's important,
yes.
that they do. I think, you know, I'm going to again mention the contact details, perhaps anything else that I might not have asked that you might feel is important for you to still explain before we conclude our conversation.
Shaida, I think you hit the nail on the head. I think you asked everything that should be,
mm-hmm.
known.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I think a take-home message is that if listeners are sitting at home and they're wondering whether they should make the call or,
yes.
or write the email, they should just do it, you know?
Yes.
Life, you get one life. It's too short to waste it being anxious and not living your full potential.
Absolutely.
You know, if one research study or one assessment, you know, even,
yes.
if you don't qualify, we,
yes.
won't leave you out in the cold. I will,
yeah.
make an effort to make a suitable referral. If you don't qualify,
yes.
you know, we'll make sure you end up with a person that you can afford, with an appropriate clinician.
Okay.
Even if it's just a support group,
right.
or or something like that.
Yeah.
So if you fall out, if you don't qualify, you will also benefit to some extent.
That is really, really great. I thank you for having been a part of the program. After, I'm going to take commercial news. After that, I will then speak about the different contact numbers and email address that I have to mention on your behalf. For now, I'd like to greet and wish you well and all the best. And I really hope that there's going to be stunning benefit from this conversation, because I'm such a supporter and feel very passionate that we need to continue with our research in order to help people with mental health difficulties in the best of way.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Shaida. I really hope the listeners respond favorably.
Right. I sincerely hope so too. So, and also to promise our listeners that next week we'll speak about obsessive compulsive disorder and the research that's taking place in regard to that disorder. So, Christine, thank you so much and all the best.
You're welcome. Happy to talk again next Sunday.
Great. Good evening.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Well, then, it's time for commercial news. When we come back, those numbers, keep your pens and paper.